Hey, and welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Nadolski. I got my co-host right here next to me in the same square.
Woo!
We're in my brother's basement, which is being redone. If you're watching this via video, you can see that there's an unfinished door behind us.
Yeah, which I got to apologize to the one person who was a little bit disgruntled about my looking distracted during one of the podcasts. I didn't realize I was on video. I was probably looking something up, just to be fair.
We don't know what he was looking at, but it was probably not legal. No. Anyway, all right. This week we're going to be talking about, I posted on my Instagram, Mark Hyman, a functional medicine doctor at the Cleveland Clinic, posted a podcast about a month and a half ago now, all about the dangers of Ozempic and GLP-1 agonists, you know, semaglutide, etc. And so I said, I want to make a quick video and go through all the issues of it, but it was so egregious and so long. They're like, we got to make an actual podcast on this and kind of address this. Yeah. It'll take a little bit longer, but that's fine.
And the concerns he raised are out there. So the concerns are not.
There's nuggets of truth.
False. There are always nuggets of truth. It's just when people take them to such an extreme that then it scares people away when the medication is appropriate. So.
Yeah, we're going to take – this is also good for addressing some of the side effects of the meds. We've done this before, but again, we should do it more regularly because people ask these questions quite often. Pancreatitis, pancreatic cancer, thyroid, not only just thyroid cancer, but even things like hypothyroidism. Is it okay to take those medicines? All sorts of stuff. So who is Mark Hyman? We've talked about him probably a little bit on the podcast before.
So
He's well known for kind of spreading pseudoscience and being this functional medicine type of doctor.
Really promotes functional medicine, which we're going to do a whole podcast on the fallacies of functional medicine, first of all. But he's a family practice doctor, actually, just like, so he did, you know, similar training, went to med school, did family practice residency, and then he was actually a rural family medicine doctor for a while before doing some time in an emergency department in Massachusetts, before he turned to this quote-unquote functional medicine deal, which is sort of a form of alternative medicine, doesn't really have any scientific substance, but historically was marketed the same way we all want medicine be, very much holistic, focused
root cause,
on life,
lifestyle.
Yeah, root cause, lifestyle stuff, except that they, you know, they create this false,
it's a false dichotomy.
Dichotomy competition because it makes it seem like, oh, well, real evidence-based medicine is dysfunctional. When in reality, real evidence-based medicine is very much supposed to be holistic, lifestyle-driven, all those things that are foundational. So, you know, he's been on Quack Watch and, you know, he has books like the 10-Day Detox Diet. He's collaborated with Robert F. Kennedy and that sort of thing. But he is the director of Cleveland Clinic's relatively new functional medicine department, and that's a whole different debate of why.
It's been out for 10 years now, 2014.
Yeah,
10 years goes by quickly because I remember when that happened, I was just finishing residency. So let's go over some of his claims that he makes in the podcast. Again, some of these things have nuggets of truth, but of course, we have to explain the nuance behind them. And as we will always say, that no drugs are perfectly safe.
Right. Of course,
these
not.
Drugs are very powerful and they have a great bit of power for improving cardiometabolic health and weight and all that type of thing. But, you know, some people do have side effects and some of these side effects can be moderate to severe.
And we should only prescribe and as patients only take medications and drugs that, you know, we feel like have a good benefit to risk ratio when it's truly indicated. So all these, you know, functional medicine doctors out there that are just ordering random hormone tests without any clinical context and then selling supplements and other types of drugs, but then they scare away from drugs where we actually know a lot about their safety benefit ratios, but we still don't just give people drugs for no good reason. And that's, I think, some of the confusion.
Yeah, that's part of this.
Like.
All right.
So this is what he said. He quote unquote says these drugs can cause permanent damage. He goes on to say bowel obstruction, gastroparesis, pancreatitis. And of course, he mentions loss of appetite, which is one of the primary mechanisms of these medications. You know, he says they're not trivial. And of course, side effects, you know, he says they occur, severe side effects occur in 10%. We'll talk about the actual data for that. And then he goes on to say, well, in the longest study is only 68 weeks. Well, that's blatantly false. And we'll talk about the big cardiovascular outcome trials that have gone on for at least a few years.
We've already had a podcast called the SELECT trial. We had that one already.
And just to talk about where is he even getting this from? there was a study, it was a fairly problematic study, which looked at...
Research letter, mind you. It wasn't a very robust study. It was a
large healthcare claims database, essentially comparing prescriptions of liraglutide, which is Saxenda for obesity, Victoza for diabetes.
One of the OG GLP-1s.
With semaglutide weekly. However, their data was before it was approved for obesity. So this was using Ozempic, actually, technically, obviously off-label before it was approved for obesity. Comparing that to Contrave, which is bupropion naltrexone, we've talked about in our obesity medicine episode. And then they look at the statistical differences of all these different side effects, and they try to control the best.
I think the thing to know about this, and I believe we've talked about this on another podcast, is this is based on EMR data. This is based on physician
and what is
diagnosis.
EMR data for people?
Electronic medical record data. So when I go in and see a patient, when a patient comes to see me, and I start charting in my note, I can put a diagnosis of whatever. It doesn't mean necessarily that they absolutely have this diagnosis, by the way. Sometimes it's a working theory of what you believe it to be. But the way that they confirmed diagnosis, or the way that they showed diagnosis or cases in this report, was based on physician diagnosis
in
the chart.
Yeah. Those are called ICDs, ICD-9 and 10, International Classification of Disease. And so they compared all those different new prescriptions, and they tried to find only use ICD codes that for obesity without any diabetes ICD codes, because they're trying to look just at that. And then they looked for biliary disease, which means like gallbladder type diseases, and pancreatitis, including, mind you, gallbladder induced pancreatitis, which causes a little confusion, bowel obstruction or gastroparesis. And for that, they actually not only used ICD codes, but if anybody was given a prescription for what's called a promotility agent that helps your stomach and intestines move faster.
So if anybody knows what those drugs are, Reglan or metoclopramide is the common one. So if somebody got a prescription for that specific medicine, they included that as a case of gastroparesis.
Yeah.
Which is problematic, and just because there are many clinicians out there, I don't do this as much, but many clinicians out there literally use that medicine for those who have nausea from GLP-1 agonists. And the reason is...
I use some Zofran.
I use Zofran, but like...
That's different. That's an antiemetic.
It works pretty well, but in some people, because the GLP-1 does actually physiologically slow down gastric emptying, it's possible some of that nausea people are getting are from the foods that are kind of sitting in their stomach, and the medicine actually helps start moving the stomach a little bit more and gets people. In fact, after a surgery, I had a biceps tendon surgery, and I was super nauseous after the post-op. They were giving me promethazine, Phenergan, as people know it, Zofran, and they're like, oh, and I was not having it. They gave me Reglan, and within minutes, it was weird. I was like sitting there going, whoa, just throwing up. Ugh. Within minutes, I was like, oh God, I feel fine to go home. It was bizarre. So imagine people coming in with, nausea and vomiting from the known side effect from this medicine. Yeah. Especially
and it's a literal mechanism of its action. When we first were able to use these as diabetes medications back in the mid-2000s, it was already known. It was promoted that, hey, this slows gastric emptying. That's part of their mechanism. That's what helps all this stuff. Part of what helps.
And it's not permanent, though. There have been some case reports allegedly of it being permanent, but it's not. I've seen in our clinic, we've had tens of thousands of patients. We've never seen it. It's never been seen in the huge trials. I'll give them the benefit of the doubt. Maybe there are a couple of cases out there, but
statistically, very minute.
So in this study, though, they included cases of those who got prescribed this Reglan or metoclopramide.
Or the ICD. Which, if you have gastroparesis, by the way, we have a lot of people with diabetes who have a complication of gastroparesis where the stomach is somewhat permanently slowed down, and that can cause people problems all the time. These medications are not contraindicated in those patients. And, certainly we have a little bit more caution. We have a lot of patients in my department with diabetes, but we have a lot of patients who still use these medications, and we talk about it. And we have methods of, you know, dietary strategy and ways to mitigate these side effects. And most of our patients, they do fine. And they have gastroparesis, real gastroparesis.
So the reason I made this is really important to know about how the study was done is because you go to the ER, the ER doctor sees, oh, they're on Ozempic or one of these GLP-1 agonists. They could give them Reglan right there, try to get them out. Boom, that would have been a case of gastroparesis, even if they didn't put it in the diagnosis. Or the doctor's like, oh, this is like gastroparesis secondary to acute, a short term. It's not even, it's not truly, you shouldn't be diagnosing it as gastroparesis because it's not gastroparesis. Right.
That requires a gastroenterologist to do a whole study.
So they're not, they're not even confirming this. Anyway, the whole point is to talk about that study, this research. It wasn't even a real robust study. It was a research letter but it was in the JAMA. And so people took that and ran with it.
And so it was just last year. There you go. So that's that part. But also, so then we're talking about gastroparesis and bowel obstruction, right? So in all the randomized controlled trials, the meta-analyses, looking at the safety of all these, there has not really been a signal raised for, you know, gastric paralysis, which is what was out there in the media.
That's what people are talking about,
gastric paralysis.
Never seen it.
But, I think that was based on a couple very literal case reports. So out of millions and millions and millions, maybe a couple, maybe that's a real thing, but that's a couple
of things. Gotta be rare.
And it's still, there are risks to all medicines. We don't just give them out to people. That's why it's not a cosmetic medicine. And then, and we already basically talked about the gastroparesis, that statistically, that's part of its mechanism. It's not really a permanent thing that's been seen in all the big trials. There's a reason we look at randomized controlled trials rather than, you know, these other things, because they're very, very well controlled and statistically reliable. All right. What about other things? So pancreatitis is a big one. We've talked about this because this has always been a real concern. So there's historically been a very
high level
of concern.
Since the beginning of these medicines coming out, because of the way the drug works on the pancreas,
literally. Remember, it improves the pancreas beta cell ability to produce insulin in a glucose-dependent manner, meaning like only when you need it, it helps it. And so there's been concern forever that these stimulating the pancreas could increase pancreatitis risk. And there were signals of it.
Yeah,
there were definitely signals of it. But the bottom line is when we look at the
huge aggregates,
all the big cardiovascular outcome trials, meta-analyses of these, there's not really statistically significant concern. And in a lot of them, there's like zero numerical concern in some of the big trials. Thousands and thousands.
The biggest one that came out, the SELECT trial, and we talked about this. We already said
this,
but
the
SELECT trial had like 17,000 patients. It went for like 4 years.
And average of 40 months.
Average of 40 months. And it wasn't statistically different. Yeah. And not even like...
Like it was like minimal. If any...
Placebo,
very, very, very small.
Placebo
number.
Had very similar.
So that's good. And we'll circle back to this when we talk about biliary disease. But just for another example, there's also been, so in the meta-analysis, though, even pancreatic cancer, that was another concern. So pancreatitis, pancreatic cancer have not differed between GLP-1 receptor agonists, treatment, and placebo. However, in these big, huge meta-analyses, they did reduce major adverse cardiovascular events, mortality, meaning death, and kidney disease. So that was a Lancet diabetes and endocrine meta-analysis back in 2021. And all the meta-analyses since then have been even more reassuring. So how about the biliary disease? So this is one area that is a real statistically significant
truth. And there's biological
plausibility. And it makes sense. So basically, in 2022, JAMA Internal Medicine published a huge meta-analysis of 76 randomized controlled trials. And here was the statistical risk of any type of biliary disease. Gallstones, pain, sludge. But this could also cause... gallbladder inflammation called cholecystitis or gallstone pancreatitis. So this is where that could happen, especially with rapid weight loss. It was 1.5% of people in the GLP group versus 1.1% in the placebo group. Now that's not huge absolute risk, but it is true. It's real.
Yeah, we see, and honestly, clinically we see this, and we do see pancreatitis, and most of the pancreatitis is from a gallstone. So what happens is when you rapidly lose weight, there's a change in the mixture of your bile, and it increases the risk of forming these gallstones. The gallstones can get into the wrong ducts and cause inflammation. Sometimes it's just your gallbladder. You got to get your gallbladder taken out, and sometimes it gets all the way into your pancreatic duct. And that's problematic, obviously. So there's biological plausibility. I've seen it. Not any of my patients.
You have to be aware of it.
These are risks. This is exactly why, like, hey, maybe we shouldn't be giving these for vanity weight loss purposes. But if somebody's at a high risk of having a heart attack, we know, and has type 2 diabetes, obstructive sleep apnea.
Extraordinary benefits compared to the risks.
The benefits is going to far outweigh the risk. Whereas now what I'm seeing, I'm getting in my DMs. I never, ever prescribe this for vanity purposes. When I say vanity purposes, there are a lot of people with obesity that want to lose weight for vanity purposes, but they still have that clinical indication of obesity. When I'm saying vanity purposes,
don't have obesity. They have clinically.
No clinical obesity, no clinical type 2 diabetes, no metabolic syndrome, anything like that. They want to literally lose like 5 to 10 pounds to fit into some clothes of some sort. And
unfortunately, the media in Hollywood kind of did that. Yeah. And then, of course, that's the whole Ozempic thing. Ozempic's indicated for type 2 diabetes. Same stuff, higher dose Wegovy, indicated for obesity regardless of diabetes. It is not indicated for cosmetic purposes like they did in Hollywood and then, you know, caused all these things.
And so now we're starting to see, you start seeing those types of people having side effects. And it's like, yeah, you shouldn't have taken
it. Don't take drugs if you don't need it.
You shouldn't have taken it in the first place. So anyway.
So I'm surprised he didn't talk about some of these psychological concerns. Because there have been some concerns raised about like depression, suicidal ideation, etc. Now, that really hasn't, been a major concerning signal in the big randomized controlled trials, but there have been hints of
post-surveillance
post-surveillance stuff. So the FDA and the European Medical Agency, they did these huge pharmacovigilance data checks, and the European one looked at liraglutide, again, semaglutide, and now tirzepatide. Of all the adverse events reported, 1.18% were of some sort of psychological manner, depression, anxiety, etc. And of those, and this is out of like hundreds of like really, really, really high numbers, there were 9 suicides that were reported. Now, this is only 2% of the reported psych adverse events. So 1% of all adverse events were psych. And of that 1%, 2%, 9 suicides, that was in the European Pharmacovigilance, and that was in the International Journal of Clinical Pharmacology.
Important to know, this is not a randomized controlled trial, so we do
just
not
report.
You cannot compare it to placebo. You cannot create cause and effect. But if those signals start changing, if it's like more than the average in a population, a normal population, not taking these medicines, you start looking into more. And this is something.
And that brings me to the FDA's that they published theirs also in 2024 in BMC Medicine. The FDA pharmacovigilance data doesn't show, there's certainly some reports, but no disproportionate reporting of self-harm or suicidal ideation. So really, both of those are very reassuring data. And those are huge, huge amounts of pharmacovigilance data.
The package insert in all weight management drugs, and this is due to Ramona Band. We talked about this, I don't know how many months ago, but they all say to monitor mood because it's possible those with obesity that are struggling with their weight that want to lose weight may be at higher risk of developing mood disorders. Now, I don't think there's anything from this medicine. However, I will say I have hundreds of thousands of followers on Instagram, and I did a poll, and I was looking through all the answers, and most everybody said, no, this medicine actually improved my anxiety and maybe improved my mood or no change. There was one person that was basically like, no, it made me not feel good. It depressed my mood.
I had a couple comments on mine, and you know, I don't have as many followers as you, but definitely there were a couple people that said, I swear to you, up and down, despite the data, that this made my mood depressed. Yeah. And so if that's that's the truth. That's the person's truth.
And
I mean, there's nothing.
There, you know, I mean,
and that's
these,
so it's something to be aware of.
These medicines, they work up in the brain and they change some of those reward pathways. And maybe it works so well in some people that it like almost dampens it so much to where they don't have any reward and they feel like kind of apathy. And in this case, this person he felt worse than apathy. So
it's just something to be aware of. We don't expect it. We should be talking about people's mental health all the time, no matter what our specialty is. We got to be looking out for people.
So if you're listening and you take these medicines and you're noticing mood changes, talk with your physician, your healthcare practitioner about it. I always talk with my patients because I just want to know.
All right. So now the final thing that he said, Mark Hyman, he said, oh, and now we're seeing increased deaths. Well, that's why we have these huge cardiovascular outcome trials, to make sure that what we're trying to do actually has real benefit, like reducing risk of heart attacks, strokes, kidney disease, et cetera. So we're talking about huge studies going all the way back to the daily liraglutide. Victoza for diabetes was the first one. I was there. I was at the American Diabetes Association conference. Everybody, it was amazing.
Didn't they do a standing ovation?
That was the Jardiance, the empagliflozin in 2015. Anyway, so all I remember, it was like a rock concert. I got swept into the huge auditorium because everyone's, all the nerds with me were like, yeah, woo. And this had to be 2015.
Before the, no, doesn't it say, don't you have it
20, the New England Journal of Medicine, 2016. Yeah. So anyways, doesn't matter. But the point is, in people with obesity, type 2 diabetes, and established cardiovascular disease, this was the first one of all these medications to show it dramatically reduced major adverse cardiovascular events, heart attacks, strokes, death from cardiovascular disease. And this literally, over 4 years in that trial, reduced risk of death, 22% cardiovascular death in that trial. In the huge 5-year extension of the exenatide weekly versus twice daily trial, that's Byetta and Bydureon for those who remember that from type 2 diabetes. That went on for a long time without any of these signals and only benefits. And then in their big cardiovascular outcome trial, 15,000 patients, 2.5 to 4.5 years, they didn't quite meet the statistical significance of reducing major adverse cardiovascular events, but there was a hint of a 14% reduced risk of death across the board, and that was New England Journal of Medicine 2017 too. Dulaglutide is Trulicity, approved for type 2 diabetes, and here's another one. This was a big cardiovascular outcome trial, median years of over 5 years. Not all of these people had established cardiovascular disease, by the way. They were also just high risk, and they had a 12% reduction in major cardiovascular outcomes. So now let's go to our favorite, or everyone's favorite, seemingly, Ozempic and Wegovy, semaglutide. So in the SUSTAIN-6 weekly cardiovascular outcome trial, this was type 2 diabetes, high cardiovascular risk. This was a relatively smaller, shorter one than all the other ones, probably because they knew they were going to do the one for obesity. But this reduced major adverse cardiovascular events by 26%. This one, interestingly, was very much driven by a reduction in stroke, which I think is important. But it, of course, trends in reduction in death across the board. And then SELECT, which we just talked about. We have a whole podcast on it a couple months ago. Those with obesity, no diabetes, they did have established heart disease. And it was a median of 3 years of exposure, 17,000 people. And it reduced the risk of major adverse cardiovascular events by 20% over 40 months. And death, so it reduced death by nearly 20%. And that was statistically significant, by the way. And they looked at other adverse events. And so there were other adverse events were mostly like the same between the drug and placebo. But I thought this was interesting that not only the cardiovascular events were reduced as serious adverse effects, but infectious serious adverse effects were reduced. Fewer surgical, you know, procedural things that had to be done to people. I don't know what that means exactly, but people seemed to be healthier, and so they weren't having that adverse effect. And somehow they had reduced respiratory infections. So we know from COVID that obesity and diabetes are not good for, respiratory infections. So maybe that's somehow.
Well, the GLP-1, receptors are all over the body. Who knows what's going on? I don't think anybody knows.
And then very importantly, so again, the concerns, are there any concerns of other gastrointestinal or other types of malignancies, neoplasms, meaning growths, tumors? And there was no signal at all for any of that stuff. And then, you know, I added in because, of course, then what about tirzepatide, which is Bounjaro and Zepbound? And we don't have the big cardiovascular outcome trial for that one yet. So that, just to be clear. But meta-analyses of all the phase 3 trials for diabetes and obesity look like there's certainly not an increase in serious or fatal adverse effects. And in fact, there's a very strong hint at reducing heart attacks, strokes, and death in all of those. They just not, that's not how they're powered, so we can't say.
So anyway, when Mark Hyman says increased risk of death, it's like, no, actually there's
literally the opposite.
Decreased risk of death. If you're using it in the right population, I don't know, like if you're
right. If you're a really healthy person without any obesity or any cardiovascular, it's not going to be studied for that probably. So
not yet.
And to be honest, the event rate for people who are healthy would probably be so low you wouldn't see a sick.
You need 100,000 people.
Yeah, million. So, anyways, any other side effects that we need to address?
No, those are the. Oh, so some people say kidney failure, as you know, they're actually renal protective.
Quite literally the opposite again. But all these trials show benefits
acutely if you become nauseous and moderate to severe nausea, which does happen with these medicines.
That's true.
If you're not getting in enough fluid, you can be at risk for an acute kidney injury, which can result in kidney failure early.
So hydration is important. Quality diet is important to mitigate the effects, the side effects.
Tell this to everybody, but if you're on the medicine, don't force your doctor to go up. I know you want to lose weight faster, but like if you're having side effects, don't go up in the dose.
We have ways to help you tolerate it, and
it's not worth it.
Luckily, we personally have dietitians who can really help people make sure they're adjusting and personalizing their diet to help tolerate the medications as needed. And it usually fits along with what we're trying to do anyways for quality measures of your diet. So
I don't think we don't have to go. There's a lot of other things he said. I think the big thing he says is that why don't we focus on. Why aren't they focusing on what actually caused the obesity?
Yeah, he says, so here's a quote from Mark Hyman. The real question is that no one asks, how did obesity triple in the last 60 years from about 13% of the population to 43% of the population? And he says, I guarantee you it's not an Ozempic deficiency. He has to use the term Ozempic because he doesn't know they're different. Everyone has been asking this since I've been in medical school. This is a huge, this is what we part of why we've been got into this.
Huge symposiums with the smartest researchers and public health officials, because ideally we'd be able to fix our environment and whatever else is going on to maybe prevent the obesity in the first place. But semaglutide, tirzepatide, and these new GLP-1 agonists, no, there is not a deficiency in those with obesity. However, the medicine works extremely well. It's extremely effective. And as you can hear, fewer deaths, if anything.
Real adverse effects.
But be aware of the side effects.
And he goes on to create all these false dichotomies. Like, why don't we just help everyone with their lifestyle? Well, we do.
Yeah, of course we do.
Everyone should be doing that. But some people need therapy.
Yeah.
All right.
I think that's it. Make sure you get this. We got to do the outro. I got to click on the thing. we're also, what else? Yeah. We're going to do a whole thing on not just Mark Hyman, but
functional medicine
in general. Because, it's intriguing getting to the root cause, but we all want to get to the root cause.
That's literally the mantra of real medicine.
And really the issue comes down to time and the medical system. And this is why I've gotten out of it. He's still trying to be in the medical system. I'm out of it because I
like to take care of people.
Yeah. I like to make cash money records in the
90s. No, it's hard. I like to rail against the dysfunctional healthcare machine. Yeah. And I'm still trying to find a way.
At this point, I'd rather not take insurance and then just allow people to just talk to me as they want to. Because it's really time and talking with people and just having more connection, I believe. So thanks for listening. Share this with a friend or family member who is considering these medicines and worried about the side effects. Again, it all comes down to making sure it's you're using it in the right patients.
Yeah.
All right.